A lack of decorum. I'd been called out on several occasions for my unprofessional attitude. I take pleasure from the criticism as if it's a secret compliment. My strengths include a genuine, authentic, and sometimes raw personality. Sometimes people confuse these things with mean. "I'm just being honest," says a person who is so suckingly rude. I believe that I eschew traditional professionalism. My niceties are also part of my genuine self. I only become rude when someone is rude to me. That's when my New Testament ideology gets thrown out for some classic eye for an eye rumbling. Besides, who is labeling or describing themselves as professional anyway? Who conveys their personality as professional? Are people still defining themselves as professional and clean cut? Do people love wearing a suit and tie and selling something to a client around the clock? I get enjoying your work, but I doubt people want the politico around their work. People can dress up, put on fake smiles, and pretend to be elevated demigods, but I prefer someone nice with the occasional smack, or a polite individual that has a rare uncouth moment. Some of the nicest people I know have their moments, whether it's tough love, genuine upset, or little anger that piles into a volcano that happens to explode for the first time in a long time. There's a saying that everyone is born with an internal instinct to kill. So if that's true, we're just savages pretending to wear proper clothes and diamonds, right? My viewpoint was confirmed by my first corporate job. Even the word corporate feels like depression put on a horrid disguise in word form. This company really prided itself on its corporate attitude. The irony was that this company was messier than a wig store after an extension sale. One of the main focuses were digital assets, but our digital media department was understaffed, regionalized, overworked, and out of touch. When COVID hit, we furloughed, that division to the bones. It's like a shoe store not having people to make, sell, promote, distribute, or handle shoes. Like a good chunk of awful corporations, this company tried to pass around duties like they were leftover food. "Would you like to do Sanders' old job? We're firing Michael, but if anything, we need people to do double Michael's old duties." Recently, I talked with a restaurant supervisor who told me about all the things he had to give up to become a supervisor. "I miss the basic things," he sighed, as if imagining a lost Atlantis or an old dog who had since passed. "I can't go out for a smoke in the parking lot anymore." In lieu of professional advancement, this poor young man can no longer vape nicotine in the neighboring paved lot. Truly a lost American dream. I become increasingly disillusioned with working in America over the years, but the pandemic made me start seeing red. Increased responsibilities and demands paired with stagnant, if not decreased, wages due to inflation. This coupled with the essential labeling were quickly discarded as soon as things became normal. I used to go to the extra mile across the board, but now, in a beautiful small personal resistance, I decided I didn't feel obliged to go the extra mile if organizations, people, or events warranted it. And there were plenty of things that I didn't even need to go half a mile for. Instead of devoting time to achieving valuable work, we'd have ridiculous, long-winded conversations about motivation. Issues as big as sugar packets would evolve into problems the size of a whole sugarcane field. An example was when a whole department complained that I dressed too skimpy for work. Imagine that the entire finance department at your workplace complained about you wearing a tank top. HR sent me an email saying, "Hey, love you, but this is a business, not the Aeropostale summer clothing advertisement." If Elon Musk offered my company millions of dollars to expand our clothing policy to include tanks, I'd be free to become a borderline nudist at work. My boss talked to me about what was called tank gate. And just to clarify, it was not a thin strap tank. It was an ordinary tank that showed off a little upper shoulder and a peak of chest. And for reference, I don't see or talk with clients, and I'm alone in an office. There's no reason to dress up, since the only people that see me only see me walking by them in the halls. "I get that clothes can be expensive on your salary," my boss began, "but maybe you can go thrifting or something." Maybe if the company paid me a livable salary, I could afford some nice clothes. I will not wear nice clothes when the company pays me poor middle-class wages. That feels like I'm encouraging the piss-poor pay. I imagine my boss witnessing my professional outfit and saying, "Wow, look at what he can afford on the abysmal salary." Management made it clear that they believed we were overpaid, as if we were millionaires doing thousand-air work, Half of the time, the staff made it so minuscule that they had no choice but to get extra work for cash. It's pretty sad for a successful company to be paying unlivable wages. Some companies seem hell-bent on making sure the employees look the part. Standardized uniforms might be one of the worst things in America. Why can't people wear a hat or a name tag? Why do we need to look like the company molested us in branding? You should dress for the job you want, my boss added in the meeting carved out to discuss professional dress wear. I was dressing for the job I wanted. The job I wanted was to not be here at all. If you think I'm dressed poorly, but don't pay me enough money to buy clothes, you have two choices. Let me dress how I want, or pay me more, and I'll buy the clothes you want. And if I presented that scenario to the boss, he would have been like, you know what? Dress like a prom dumpster baby. I'll talk to Linda, and Linda over in human resources. You can wear tank tops as long as we don't have to pay you a living wage. The professional optics and demands came from the same company that refused to have a proper working bathroom. I don't expect the Hilton Hotel VIP bathroom with homemade potpourri, scented candles, wicker doors, and walls instead of stalls, but our work bathroom was sloppily constructed and smelled like raccoon urine. One time, someone from the national branch walked into our office, pinched their nose, scoured their face, and exclaimed, "This office smells like urine." "We are fixing the bathrooms," my grand boss announced one day. I was surprised that he was excited to spend money. Like Ebenezer Scrooge and Scrooge McDuck, my grand boss was notorious for penny pinching and frugality. He would constantly brag about how he was saving the company money while we fired people simply to save money and let their jobs vacant. "What's the plan to fix the bathrooms?" someone asked casually, knowing the bathroom discussion was a sensitive topic. It was the equivalent of smaller big boobs. We didn't talk about them. "Well, the first thing we want is a massive fan to suck out all the scent out of the bathrooms so it doesn't leak into the office." And as my grand boss dawdled on the dreams of the bathrooms, I don't think he realized that none of the bathroom dreams would come true. The fan, which was supposed to suck the shit out of the room, was more of a soft breeze. Simple bathroom equipment, like the soap dispenser, just didn't work. It was as if we had time-transported someone from the 1700s to build the bathroom. You could wave your hand in 1,000 different ways like a Janet Jackson choreography routine, yet the soap dispenser refused to hand over its bubblegum, pink, sticky, medicinal goop. The best part was that the soap container would be cracked open as if someone was trying to steal the soap. To receive soap, you'd have to milk the bag of soap from within the dispenser. The paper towel roll didn't roll out of the canister. You'd often see wet hand and palm prints on the paper towel roll as if we were playing a murderous game of Clue. Today's mystery, who left their bare-ass palm on the thinner-than-a-pencil-shaving paper towel roll? You probably have noticed a theme. The toilet paper would get stuck in the holder, which of course didn't work either. Consequently, the toilet paper looked like my hair during humidity, a mess of rolls and strips. It was as if Wolverine was wiping his derriere and shaving the toilet paper for the other staff members. We lived with a medieval European bathroom. That is, out on the streets and shit rivers, pedaled away from the city, but constantly swallowing and sticking around like a perturbed familial guest in your spare room. A coworker of mine would fund out of her own pocket fancy soaps for the staff bathroom. These weren't dollar brand or Christmas clearance soaps. This coworker brought in lemon rind, thyme sassafras soap, and ginger orange tea blossom. It wasn't seasonal sale soap. This was full price Bath & Body Works soap. It was an upgrade over the provided strep medicine that was disguising itself as soap. Imagine going from Walmart brand ramen to authentic ramen in downtown Tokyo. It was nice of my colleague to provide soap. She was like Robin Hood. But instead of stealing from the rich, she just gave to the poor. But I couldn't believe someone was regularly throwing down multiple dollars to provide soap for the heathens. I wouldn't give a penny to the workplace, let alone meet the bare minimum bathroom standards a corporate company should provide. The one thing I assumed worked was the self-flushing toilet until one morning, my colleague approached me with a worried look. "Did you just go to the bathroom?" Morgan asked. "Yeah?" I wasn't going to lie, but I was worried about what would happen next. "Because you didn't flush." Waves of horror and embarrassment hit me like a natural disaster in one of those Dwayne The Rock Johnson apocalypse movies. "Aren't the toilets self-flush?" I questioned. In 2022, on this planet Earth, what corporate bathroom didn't have an auto flush?
No, because I saw what you'd left behind.
I have a very high fiber and eclectic diet of cuisines, and knew that whatever healthy deposit I had left behind, it was not designer or museum ready.
Wait, I thought the toilets were automatic, I asked, because I haven't been manually flushing for months.
Imagine finding out you've been leaving bathroom treats for your colleagues over the last few months. I usually had my headphones in, blaring some audio to keep myself active and awake. Had I not been hearing the sound of the flush? I immediately investigated as if I were Sherlock Holmes. Upon investigation, the toilet was indeed an automatic flushing toilet, so why wasn't it flushing? Turns out, it was just defective, because sometimes it flushed and sometimes it didn't. It was like a game show. Will it flush? I had another coworker who had discovered a lopsided tile that created a tripping hazard. Imagine arriving to work and hitting your head in the sink because of a jutting bathroom tile. Part of me wondered, was it worth seeing if I could try and trip? See if I can get some workers' comp? When I was training a new hire, they went to the bathroom as a person and returned as a ruin.
What is with that bathroom? The new hire exclaimed. The toilet was clogged, and there were pubes on the toilet.
I wasn't even surprised. I just nodded in a proletarian resolution. I felt like a character smoking a cigar in a leather chair asking, "Where have you been?" And that iconic urine smell, it just never left. Like a witch who constantly outwitted the town, the urine smell permeated the office. It felt like we had an office cat who refused to use the litter box. So instead of upping the fan suction power, using heavy cleaning duty supplies, or even going to Dollar Tree and grabbing something to put into the bowl, we admitted defeat. However, the most effective move the company came up with was just adding a bottle of Febreze in the bathroom. We live in that Febreze commercial, except there's a giant turd in the toilet, and not even a momentarily lingering smell of Hawaii is enough to handle the vast issues. Did management really believe that the presence of a Febreze bottle would dismantle decades of urine corrosion? Imagine walking into a house where the carpets are filled with cat urine and thinking that a single cylinder bottle of scent product will permanently change the situation. One time I went to use the executive-approved purchase of Febreze to discover it was empty. I had a lot of questions. Why would someone not throw out the empty bottle? How long had this bottle been empty? Didn't this bottle just get plinked in the bathroom so we have a problem if we're going through a whole Febreze bottle in less than a business week? The irony is that people constantly calling you out for being unprofessional tend to do some absolutely bonker things that are just as unprofessional. The big boss in charge of my corporate gig sent an email titled, "Meeting with Boss's Name." Instantly, I felt my asshole tighten three sizes that day, like some anxious millennial Grinch. No one wants to meet with their boss, and you certainly don't want to meet with the grand boss. In my entire time working for the company, I had never been called to a meeting with the big boss. The grand boss was an individual who would bite with sharp comments about wearing sandals as if only poor people wore sandals. This was someone who slashed a budget as if he was a slasher murderer. I could practically hear the 1990s from the old Dell computer that slugged onward and upward like a Confederate soldier who had not gotten the memo that the war was over. They were the individual who casually flaunted their wealth and success, nothing super overt like gold bars being brought to the office. But there were mentions of penthouse living, fancy watches, and clothes that looked like Full Sail Price Men's Warehouse and a subtle, "Look at me, I'm Sandra D." After my heart attack subsided over the email's subject line, I clicked inside to read the message. The email had been sent to all the production staff. The production department was the lowly of the heavenly angels. While we worked for heaven, we were so close to falling off the clouds and tumbling into hell. We were regularly disrespected both in mistreatment and financial compensation. Think of hazing the freshmen when it came to a college fraternity, but withholding money instead of pushing beer. The production staff were the shovelers of shit. We held onto the ladder so others could climb in lifeboats before the boat sank. We were coming in during COVID, the only ones who, when sick, got told to work through it, never get small gifts. No, not the producers. That would be like giving a gift to the help.
Even after the COVID-19 pandemic when I got sick, my employer told me to power through it, like I was on the last mile of a 5K race. This, of course, after the leagues of email, training, and personal conversations about the ever-importance of taking sick time. Now, if someone important at work got ill, we would roll out the 5-star treatment for them. Need a week off to deal with your cough? Take 2 to be safe. My first thought upon seeing this email was, oh, this is it. It was the firing that I wanted so I could claim unemployment while I applied and waited to land my next dream job. That dream situation echoed when you and your first date mutually agreed that there was no need for a second date. You both release a sigh of relief, smile brightly, and mean it when you say, I wish you the best. Getting let go from this job would have freed me from the toxic capitalist culture crammed with ego, outdated machinery, and the constant squeezing of job roles into my role. Letting me go meant they could save money by not paying out a meager wage that would be considered low class. Oh, and I wouldn't have to smell the urine again. The worst part of this mystery meeting was how a few production team members went to their direct supervisors for appeasement and just found it more confusing. When pressing higher staff members on the content of the meeting, they giggled as if they were schoolgirls hiding secret crushes. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Are things I want to hear when a surprise birthday party is planned for me. The next day, en route to the meeting, the production staff clucked like chickens who figured we were off to slaughter. We didn't see the sharp guillotines, a production line, cellophane, or styrofoam packaging, but we could smell it. The company stock was lower than $1 per share. A single piece of gum was more expensive than a share of our company. Of course, the entire production staff seemed unlikely. Who would schlep the shit, if not shit schleps? Could they really outsource the jobs to India? My grand boss began the meeting like the lord of the manor, ready to yell at the servants. The production staff sat around the conference table like the cheaper Walmart edition of the Avengers. Management sat with Cheshire Cat grins as if they were employees at Disney and were being threatened by gunpoint to smile. Well, I heard some of you thought this was a mass firing. Let me assure you, that's not happening, my grand boss chuckled. If anything, that would be a one-on-one conversation. Cue the canned sitcom fake laughter over the track from the present supervisors and some of the production staff. My grand boss thought this was the comedy club and was testing a tight 5-minute set. At this point, I just kept sipping my giant jug of water. I knew it was essential to keep my colossal mouth shut. I have a tendency to spew with no filter, but I knew I would remain pretty quiet if I was constantly sipping water. The news was that my office had acquired limited free parking passes, and the production staff would share them. Most of the production staff parked at meters, and would trek down every 2 hours to quench the meter. It sounds expensive, but I only spent $2 to $3 a day at a meter versus the 7 to 11 price of the nearby garages. And since we were paid so low, literally every penny counted. Think about it. Saving $4 a day is $20 a week, $80 a month. It wasn't that bad of a deal, and I was impressed that, for once, we received a benefit. The mood forever changed when my boss dropped an asshole quip. Think of this parking pass as a raise. The whole room did a half-groan, half-laugh combo that sounded like the live audience on the set of Friends. At best, it was just a clueless blunder. At worst, it was insensitive and stupid. It was like my grand boss believed he was buying us a drink at the bar when they were grabbing a lemon wedge for our glass of water. I have a whole list of terrible things about the professional workplace that I will write about here. If you're not interested, skip a couple pages for less complaining segments of this essay. One of the worst parts of the professional workplace is the amount of stupid, redundant, pointless meetings. These meetings were bloated, similar to the previous sentence in this paragraph, which used 3 similar adjectives. It inspired me to write the song Could Have Been an Email, in which I sing, This could have been an email. I don't think Shakespeare could write that. Granted, explaining email to Shakespeare would probably make him pop a blood vessel. Life really does inspire one's magnus opus. Most of the meetings I had at my first job were more social catch-ups than momentous work-related discussions. People would talk about weekend plans, develop ideas they would be too lazy to accomplish, and let us know what streaming platform they were watching. I didn't hate the light chat. I just hated the guise that we had an important meeting while praising or bombasting the latest Netflix original. Sometimes that meeting gets canceled, and your initial euphoric wave is replaced with anxiety. Maybe the staff is still having the meeting, but now it's about you. You.
Your work, personality, choices, abilities, and skills are now the main reason there's a meeting that you're doing a terrible job. But in reality, even if the meeting was happening, it would have people talking about the new falafel place they went to, or whether Julie Garner from Ozark deserves every single Emmy. But it wasn't even at my workplace. I had frustrations with many corporations I didn't work for. I was like Cleveland's Martin Luther, except I replaced religion in the 1700s with current worker conditions. There are plenty of jobs that didn't post the salary, ridiculous, with terrible expectations. I hate companies that make you wear a uniform. Most companies' work uniforms look like they asked Ayn Rand to create the uniform with a 1980s jail in mind. It's as if companies design their uniforms just so customers judge the staff. If you're a company proud of your products and brand, wouldn't you want the wage slaves to look hot and sexy? Target's law of having employees just wear a red shirt can be confusing. Talk about a fun game. Is that a Target employee or just a customer wearing red? There are two types of job interviews. There are interviews where it's not an interview, but a conversation that ends with you being hired. I imagine it's like when those rich boys get their internship at daddy's firm. Hey, can I get a job? Yay! I just did an interview for a part-time job and they were so impressed that they said, "We don't know how, but we're going to make it work. We want to bring you on full-time." It was the equivalent of when you go on a first date and they propose. And if you're a bit attention-seeking and a little low in esteem, your instinct is to say, "Stop. Oh my gosh, you're so sweet. Thank you." The second type of interview is where they do not give a single fuck. They don't want to interview you. They don't want to be doing their job. You're why they have to work today, and they hate you. And no matter what you do, they make a stank face as if you are only doing this interview to destroy them. Perhaps the biggest sins in the professional workplace are the jobs that you have to re-enter the resume into a file. I wish I had more epic stories about handing in my 2 weeks' notice. When I worked at a tropical restaurant, I wrote, "Dear Diary, I'm handing in my 2 weeks. Notice," on a piece of paper to the manager on duty. The assistant manager told me, "I can completely take you off the schedule if that's easier." Shocked, I agreed. For some reason, I was waiting for them to beg me to stay. I wanted them to feel the hurt of my departure. I wanted them to beseech me, toil for a relationship repair. I imagined managers fawning over me with compliments, pay raises, and the assurance that my demands would be solved. But Pink Floyd was the real winner because I was just another brick in the wall. I've had tons of odd jobs over the years. I momentarily worked in a bookstore chain that we shall refer to as Harnes and Fable. I thought working there would be excellent because I love reading, writing, and being surrounded by books. I have a lot of childhood memories of reading books in the Harnes and Fable Darn Books Cafe and using birthday and Christmas gift cards to purchase books. I can close my eyes and smell the non-caffeinated frappuccinos, the pages of books, and my father talking about how buying books was a waste of money when you could read them in the bookstore or get them at the library. My father was definitely the type of customer that Harnes and Fable hated, but could you call someone a customer when they never purchased anything? My nostalgia was quickly bulldozed by asinine standards. One of the standards we were judged on was the number of memberships we could close on the unsuspecting public. The membership was a $25 program that only made sense if you spent a lot of money at the bookstore. Granted, you'd get 10% off all retail and cafe and 30% off hardcovers, but you'd still have to spend a couple $100 for the membership deals to kick in. To the average college student buying Hamlet or the uncle trying to pick an educational present, this was not a reasonable membership price or benefit. The best time to push the memberships was during the holiday when people came to shop for their massive families and friends. Some people got a free membership just because by the time they bought over $200 of products, the members' coupons deducted their total by $30 or $40. Occasionally, a guest would refuse the basically free membership, perhaps thinking they were being enrolled in some credit card scheme or auto-enroll product, so we just apply for the membership credit but give the membership to someone else. And why? Because we had a quota of memberships to meet. We wouldn't let a free membership go unspent. The best part of that job was the four adult women managers who formed their apocalyptic horseman quartet. One was the lovely motherly type, another stern and emotionless, the third was quick to anger and snappiness, while the last would just try to get things done. It was like witnessing a sitcom in real time. I'll never forget my favorite colleague, although I have forgotten her name. She always had some sad relationship but spicy sexual stories that made my $9 an hour worth it. Eventually, when I went full-time in my first professional job, I explained that I needed to be temporarily be taken off the schedule and that I might return in the future. I knew I wouldn't return in the future, but my Libra personality felt confrontational saying otherwise. They reached out during the holiday season later that year, and I brushed them off with an excuse of how busy my full-time job was. I received a dismissal email later in the week that offended me at the time. I was, and still am, very bad about letting bridges be closed and sink into the lake. I always feel like I need to keep my bridges in stasis, as if I want to return to them. I knew I would never return to the bookstore, but part of me wanted the option of returning. I do this with relationships all the time. In situations of mutual neglect, I'll refuse to fully cave in out of some sheer justice. I once had a colleague, not her real name Demi, who had a bold personality. She was half-protective mother cub who could bake a mean cake, and half-destructive minx who could destroy you tenfold. She is an inspiration to seize what you want, give what you can, and not anyone tell you otherwise. After months of tenacious battling with management, things came to a grand finale during the heated discussion revolving around Demi's employment. She told our boss to kiss her fat ass and tossed her staff credentials at him before exiting. He watched, wide-eyed, as she left the building. I was really nervous putting in my 2 weeks notice at my first professional job. I had heard stories of workplaces that went ballistic, but the staff handled the situation well. I could feel my sphincter lessen, and finally, I felt a deluge of stress and drama leave my body. I had unlocked the ultimate level of unmotivation. I began to blatantly scrimp on my duties. What could they do at that point? Fire me? In the past, I had anxiety about messing up, which consumed me to the point where I became a living anxiety bomb due to explode. But in those last 2 weeks, my stress had deflated, leaving an empty balloon chilling through the final stage. The final exit interview was hilarious. I pointed out that my absence would leave giant holes in the department. I was the only one certified in specific applications and programs. I hadn't showcased complete initiative lately, but I knew they wouldn't quickly fill the amount of enterprise, expertise, and hunger I brought to the table. My boss, ever a skeptic, got the new hire into the exit interview. My boss didn't even know what programs we used, so referred me to quiz the new hire. He had minimal experience in many programs and applications that I utilized daily around the office. Not all of these things were needed or mandatory, but losing out on the only one capable would create an enormous gap. Nobody was okay when the only sushi chef left the Japanese restaurant staff. While I don't have many storming out stories about leaving a job, I have plenty of botched job interviews. One time I interviewed for what sounded like a nonprofit. It was one of those scammy organizations that sent people door-to-door collecting money. The money you collect is part of how much you get paid. Luckily, we were in the neighborhood of my grandmother, so I crashed my grandmother's church to pretend to get signatures. I refused to get money out of people for this corporation, so I wrote 4 or 5 faux signatures, which impressed the crew.
No one gets money on their first time out, the other said with a shrug. You did great.
On my way out, the hiring manager told me she would reach out in a couple months. I nodded, not having the heart to tell her I wouldn't take the job. I spent the rest of the month worried that I would have to confront the hiring manager and turn down the job. Thankfully, they never called me again. I suppose they filled the position with someone who enjoyed the scam. I had a few job interviews which framed themselves as event management, only to be gigs working stalls at stores with samples or surveys. I hated that my time was purposefully misused, and each time ended the interview giving them the professional equivalent to mess off. It doesn't feel accurate to say that the position is event management, when in reality it's giving samples, presenting surveys, or asking people to schedule an appointment for a large-scale product. One job interview for one of these survey jobs dared to lump me with another candidate.
We'll just do a joint interview for time, the manager said as I sat down with a mousy woman who looked like she was waiting for the cops to bust us at any time.
I was so hot-tempered that I thought I had momentarily become a Taurus, ready to show the world what a raging bull I was. This company had the audacity to mislead me on this job and then want to save time bullshitting that you place me with someone else? Another job blatantly lied, saying they were looking for marketing positions when they were clearly looking for management for their abysmal retail spaces. The worst part was they got me twice with the same interviewer. I told them the second time to take me off the listing, but they had the audacity to reach out the following week about an upcoming group interview. I'm sorry, I texted back. You completely misrepresented the position. Please never call me back. The most frustrating job situation I've had wasn't with strangers, but with an acquaintance. A fellow wedding DJ, let's name him Shane, was hiring hosts for his trivia side of his business.
I interviewed and was, of course, super qualified. I clarified that I wouldn't be DJing weddings for him, and that my supervisors at the company I DJ weddings for would be fine if I did trivia for Shane. Shane ghosted me over the position at the time, which was okay. I always have multiple blowpokes in the fire. My boss later told me that Shane had declined to hire me out of respect and as a favor to the company I worked for. I have yet to confront Shane on that information, but I want to. It makes me feel like a piece of meat that others can utilize. My agency was destroyed. For what? Brownie points with the company that I worked for and who didn't care? How is this a favor, Shane? Your company isn't a threat to anyone. If anything, I was doing you a favor. Also, why not say something to me? I may engage in unprofessionalism, but ghosting a friend and a colleague in the industry is probably rock bottom. Maybe one of these days I'll say something, but I'll probably chicken out. Instead, I'll secretly roll my eyes whenever I see a Facebook post about his integrity and character. I've been ghosted on a few fantastic opportunities. One lady bought me a drink at Market Garden for a part-time job with her company. After emptying the glass and saying goodbyes, she too became empty on the news. I was beyond qualified, but I think my schedule made her anxious. People look at my two-page resume and think I work 100 hours a week. Once in a while, that might be the case. A vast majority of my current various side roles might only be for one or two evenings a month. It looks more impressive than it actually is. When I was on the job hunt in early 2022, I managed to make it to many final interviews for jobs in the content creation, social media world. I would meet with CEOs who left me feeling sour.
"We work 9 to 5, no exceptions around here," one CEO explained. "We're trying to make sure people work."
Funny, because your social media is deader than a Civil War graveyard, and your current logistics plan feels like it's run by freshmen in a frat house. One job turned me down because the CEO thought I was overqualified.
"Your background seems to be in content creation, and we're looking for someone to do more social media management," the CEO said, as if he knew what he was talking about. Unfortunately, while he might have accolades, awards, and degrees, I knew he did not understand that field in particular. Also, he was an older man. What older man without specific experience really knows what they're talking about when it comes to digital media? I discussed my CEO woes with Monica, my best friend and expert on business matters.
"Well, what is the CEO going to say?" Monica muttered. "Don't work hard. Have boundaries in the workplace. The research shows that a lot of them are sociopathic anyway."
Although I detest acting professionally in a capitalist workplace, I conform to a decorum while teaching, especially when teaching today's youth. It's one thing to be a blackguard in a professional workplace or with friends, but I'm not trying to be on Fox 8 for corrupting children with improper language. I spent a semester teaching English and poetry to students who didn't want to learn the subjects. It was a constant uphill battle, and the only thing that got me through the semester was promising free time upon completion of lessons and practicum. While waiting for students to leave, a fourth grade student asked me if I was celebrating Columbus Day. This was back in 2021, so I had already discovered via social media that Christopher Columbus was terrible. "No, I don't think there's a reason to celebrate," I explained. Also, he wasn't that great of a person. My fourth grade student smiled.
"That was a test," she declared, "and you passed."
"Oh, thanks," I said nonchalantly.
"He's a bad man," she continued. "Did you know Christopher Columbus raped animals?"
You could hear the large machine brakes going off in my head.
"He did that?"
I didn't want to know why a fourth grade girl understood the concepts of rape and bestiality, but you could tell in my tone that I was intrigued and aghast simultaneously. Part of me wanted to hear no more of it, but there was a more prominent part, the tonal version of "spill the tea."
"He did," she continued.
I did some casual research and found that Columbus probably was a rapist of Caribbean women and young girls. Columbus did mistake manatees for mermaid, perhaps the only relatable-ish element of Columbus's persona, but raping animals, even an excellent historical figure would be questionable under such a claim. Another fourth grade student joined my writing club because she was passionate about writing. I was super jazzed that she was engaged on a subject I dedicated personal and professional time on. "Are you working on anything currently?" I asked as she pulled out her notebook.
"Yes, it's a ghost story."
Ghost stories can be PG. I deduced it would be a cute spook situation. Kids lost in an abandoned house, maybe a vampire or zombie. No ghost story I was aware of involves knowledge about or creativity of historical figures and sexual escapades with animals.
What's your story about?
It takes place at the Cecil Hotel, the girl explained.
Immediately, all the air left my body, and I saw sunspots in my vision. The Cecil Hotel? I questioned. For those who don't know, the Cecil Hotel is a haunted hotel that features many acts of depravity, including being the home of many serial killers. A girl most likely committed suicide in a water tank on the roof. It was a whole Netflix documentary, and material that was definitely not suited for a fourth grader. I was 26 going on 12 and thought that the material was too heavy for me.
Have you heard of it?
My writing student asked, as if she had been discussing a rare kid's anime show instead of a murder hotel. Yes, I nodded. I didn't know what to say. I wasn't an education major, just an educated man trying to educate. And besides, I doubt education majors have a specific class that addresses how to talk to fourth graders about historic bloody hotels of hate. She read me the story, which was very good for her age group. It featured drawings decked with blood and other true crime elements. In the end, I thanked her for sharing and gave her a tip about how she could replace the word said with various dazzling synonyms. I was part of a film camp that was more strenuous than boot camp. I was tasked to lead 14 student films, finish the shooting, and oversee the editing in 8 days. To say the job was stressful would be like saying it's slightly uncomfortable to sit on the spikiest cylindrical cactus. One student immediately made themselves known as a bold personality. Their name was Malise, and since you might be reading this, I must clarify the pronunciation. It's not Malice, as in my boss has malice for the receptionist. It's Malise, as in Malise is up next month. I actually had no problems with Malise throughout the camp experience. I'm confident in the assumption that Malise grew up, whether with family or in school, having to be tough. They enjoyed TikTok and K-pop and branded brutal honesty as a personality trait. I always treat younger kids like adults until you make me treat you like a child. The other adults in the room were quick to demonize Malise and would always watch like a priest looking for sin in his congregation. Malise's proposed film was rough. I wasn't sure if the writing, the overarching confusing narrative, or the off-camera elements made certain moments underwhelming. It's like creating a superhero movie, but all the action scenes happen off-camera, but are constantly referenced in the film's final cut. That battle was wicked, says the superhero who continues and constantly references a fantastic match that the audience doesn't see. We shot Malise's film in the last 2 days, and by we, I mean other people. We legitimately had 2 days to finish editing 10 other pieces. By that point, a few of the other stragglers had fallen to the wayside. I had no choice but to send surrogates off to battle to execute Malise's piece. Drama ensued on set. It was the type that would land us a deal at Bravo. Students complained to Malise about problems with the script and production. Malise ricocheted back devastating aggression that knocked large holes in the SS morale. Malise was upset because people seemed to be pushing back on particular problems with the piece. "You're the director," I remember telling Malise while chopping footage because there was no time to stop editing. "You have to lead, but be effective. Listen to concerns and decide whether to fix them or overlook them." When you ask people to work on your creative problems for free, you basically become a servant to them in the compliments department. My friend Noni pulls out the stops with food spreads and drinks for her crew. I compliment people so hard, you'd think I was trying to bed and wed them. I remember trying to film a music video with a friend, and they accidentally didn't record a whole sequence. I didn't notice we were missing the footage until after we had shot it and I was editing it. Instead of being upset, I accepted it as part of the process of having free labor. Sometimes you mess up a shot, you spend a few hundred on snacks, and other times you're pulling out a thesaurus so you can successfully compliment people. Malise, who could manipulate malice like a pro, did not ease the concerns, but set fire to them. I could hear the yelling from the hallway, all because Malise couldn't find a few people needed for the scene they were about to film. Moments later, the door to the editing suite opened, and Malise sat down with a huff. I didn't say anything. What was I going to say? "Hey, I heard that giant fight in the hallway. I assume everything is fine?" That's how you know I'm an optimist. The stomping, huffing, and puffing clearly indicated a few houses being blown over. Moments after Malise entered the room, the camp leader, not her real name Patty, came in. I could tell that Patty was ready to lay down the law like an old sheriff in a Western movie. I continued editing footage as if I wasn't in the room.
First thing, this is my camp. If you don't like it, you can leave, Patty threatened.
I let out a small piece of air, like a tire popping. Patty had a homily of rules, expectations, and criticism to spew over Melisse. People either pulled out lists and discussions for organizational purposes or throwdowns, and I doubted this was about how to organize their piece. I didn't know exactly how this would play out. I doubted Melisse would remain calm. I buckled down but continued trying to add music to one of the students' films. Fine, then I'll leave. Melisse grabbed their bag in a mannerism that was basically an FU before leaving the editing suite. Patty was shook. There were definitely a couple seconds where an internal thought went, oh no, they didn't. I didn't come from a traditional background on how to be an educator or an educational leader, but I knew telling a student like Melisse, if you don't like it, you can leave, was an invitation for them to leave. Patty followed Melisse, and the editing suite was momentarily quiet. Suddenly, other students burst into the editing suite to discuss the drama. One student even ripped up the script for the shoot in a funny, dramatic fashion. I try not to listen in or ask questions, but that's like asking the Cocoa Puffs mascot to not go insane over the presence of his favorite thing, a good story. Since graduating from undergrad, I had been dreaming of the chance to teach a college class. I finally got the opportunity at the beginning of 2022, having been called in to teach a lesson on the first day of class. By a serendipitous strike of wonder, my mentor and friend Lisa had taken a new job and had mentioned that I should take over. This opportunity ended up being one of the best I had ever received. On my first day, I told the room that I had been asked to teach the class less than a day ago, and that we would officially start on the next day of class. One student then asked, well, if the class doesn't start till the next class, do I have to be here? My eyebrows rose 2 inches at that moment, and it took so much restraint not to verbally slap this man across the face with a sassy comeback. In some of my more uncouth moments, I would have countered with statements as extreme as, well, don't be here at all and drop the class. Or sassy ones like, remind me not to attend your class. But instead, I kill them with kindness. Kill them with kindness equivalent to emptying out innards and letting beach crabs feast on a half-alive, half-dead version of your former foe. But with kindness. My lack of class becomes most apparent in social situations. Without an institution to semi-please or represent, my natural raw energy blossoms like a weed in the wild. The more casual a situation or location is, the quicker my filter is to unrobe itself. A friend once told me their grandmother had 19 children, and I drunkenly quipped, her poor vagina must have looked like an Arby's sandwich. It killed the table, but it was the kind of joke fueled by the bar and previous drinks, not something I would have said sober and in a professional setting. One time I had to present a PowerPoint to my city council, and I implied that their social media was abysmal. We can't all have an MA in communications, the mayor, who didn't like me, sassily said. We could try and have some kind of presence, I countered. There was a suggestion that we have some staff members schedule out posts for the next 3 months, and I actively snorted. I hope that's on public record somewhere. My mother, sister, and 2 nieces went to a tea party at one of those houses that either looked Southern or British. It's the type of house that most serial killers own. With younger children in a tea house, one literally experiences the metaphor, bull in the china shop. There was a small room that was a store where everything was at least minimally $40 and made out of breakable materials. It was just shelves and shelves of fragile china. My sister and I were steering my nieces like little bulldozers that would otherwise knock into the shelves of china. It was like playing one of those classic 2D video games with the joystick. I get that we were visiting a tea house, but having rooms upon rooms of instantly breakable pieces feels like bad business. Our server was an older woman who would describe herself as excellent. At the time, my nieces were 3 and 2, so they were a little rowdy. Not outrageously rowdy, just the average amount for a healthy child. A child that isn't a little rowdy would be weird. The tea selection at a tea house is a terrible time if you're indecisive. They have practically every tea in existence, and even rousing flavors that seem too wild for tea. Can you really have chocolate tea? Isn't that just watered-down chocolate? Why not just have hot chocolate? Our tea is good when it's made into a golfer, our waitress explained. I was shocked that I was not familiar with a golfer. I was a self-described cocktail lover who preferred Long Island iced teas, but would be naturally curious about a drink called the golfer. I mused over what it might be, tea and rum,
Tea and vodka?
Oh, what booze comes with the golfer? I asked curiously. Did this tea shop even have a liquor license? We were in Ohio, which I figured was conservative regarding handing out liquor licenses. Our waitress laughed and gave me a look like she was explaining the color red to a 20-year-old.
Oh, I call it the golfer, but you would know it as a half tea, half lemonade.
So a half and half with lemonade? I confirmed, desiring for us to be on the same page.
Yes.
Gotcha, so an Arnold Palmer. The waitress soured a little bit by the name, as if she had dated the real-life Arnold Palmer and did not want the delicious combination of iced tea and lemonade to be referred to in his honor. Maybe it was a feminist thing? She didn't want the drink to sound masculine? That didn't make sense either. The golfer sounds more masculine than Arnold Palmer, because I feel like I might walk into a gay bar and meet someone named Arnold Palmer on stage doing drag.
Hey girls, it's me, Arnold Palmer,
a drag queen would say with jazz hands and zealously applied makeup. Weird enough, I had another run-in at a tea shower. My friend Joanna hosted a beautiful baby shower with an Alice in Wonderland theme at a tea party restaurant. It was fancy, elegant, beautiful, and any term I would never use to describe myself. Joanna's family had decorated the room with all sorts of beautiful centerpieces. The lunch was mini sandwiches, since we were at a tea parlor. The problem with being a husky man is that mini sandwiches don't fill you up. For ladies, some might have a couple mini sandwiches and become full, or maybe they would be ladylike and claim they were stuffed on 2 pieces of bread and 5 cucumbers. I figured these women would leave and circle the Taco Bell drive-thru. I was shoveling sandwiches down my gullet. In my defense, I had double-digit mini sandwiches, but altogether, it probably made 2 sandwiches. One of Joanna's friends who attended the baby shower had her own baby. Naturally, everyone cooed over the cute child. I'm not one for utilizing the same compliments. All around me, I heard, "Cute baby. What a cute baby." And, "That baby is cute." It just feels forced and unoriginal. I like to make innovative and elevated compliments. "Your baby has the eyebrows of a young Angelina Jolie." Or, "I smell a future scholar of business." It's much more original than the regular compliment peddling. At least I can provide a genuine and intriguing compliment. I hate gender reveals simply because I want to know more about the future child's personality. Instead of revealing biological sex, reveal to me a psychic prediction about whether or not your child will be a bitch or a bastard, smart or dumb, troublesome or polite. A personality reveal would be much more exciting for all involved. I looked at Joanna's friend's cute baby, although I wasn't going to say cute. Immediately, I decided that if no one else would provide original comments, I would. I noticed the baby looked slightly tan and said, "I love his tan." The whole table paused for a second, and I was worried that maybe I had inferred that the mother was bad for giving her child time in the sun. My friend Brett, who was sitting next to me, whispered, "The child is mixed. The dad is black." I felt my soul depart my body. Having been in a tea house with white people, I had wrongly assumed that the child was white with a suntan. I remember clutching Brett's leg next to me and holding on as if tightening my grip around my friend's thigh would save me from damnation. Thankfully, the rest of the tea party continued with no controversial statements from me. It was a reminder that sometimes creative compliments are best left simple and sweet. The best workplaces for creatives are the ones with fellow no-holds-barred creatives. I teach some classes with a nonprofit, and we host quarterly meetings and sessions. Recently, we discussed not getting involved if there were physical assaults between students.
"You should try and find ways to de-escalate situations before kids go down on each other,"
my boss explained, which caused my face to open in shock. I was immediately thinking, "go down on each other," as the sexual euphemism. My boss was standing next to me, so everyone's eyes were in the direction of my slightly horrified face visible to the rest of the table.
"You mean fighting to go down on each other?" I questioned, allowing the room to erupt in laughter.
A bit later, we talked about designs and someone suggested that working backward made the most sense.
"Imagine it's like a recipe," she explained. "Think of it like you've decided to make a pot pie and then figure out the ingredients you'll need."
"A pot pie sounds kind of heavy for summer," I muttered, causing her and the rest of the room to laugh. I love being in these spaces, even if the jokes don't fully land. Ironically, her recipe metaphor was apt due to a recipe challenge we were asking the community to help out with. I immediately let out a "I could provide the recipe of cereal" comment. It wasn't my best joke. I've learned to finally accept that sometimes I'll need to embrace professionalism when the time is present. But often,
I let the mask of professionalism slip, if not, disregard it altogether. Recently in my new job, we were talking about an event for families called Self-Love Day. When I read the title the week before, I immediately thought of self-pleasuring. But then I thought, Matt, you might be too creative, too bright, too perverted, or something, because I doubt anyone else thinks this. At the department meeting, my boss goes, "So we want to change the name because it feels masturbatory." The entire table chuckled as we bounced off different names. "We might as well name it the Jackoff Event," I said under my breath. Immediately, I wondered if I had screwed the pooch, only to find a couple people near me chuckling over my joke. Thank goodness this workplace didn't mind my slip of decorum. I've been enjoying my latest forays in the professional world that I'll eventually share, but communicating about it now feels, well, like a lack of decorum.